Hey, hi. Hey, Jenny. Hi, Bonnie. We're back.
I'm back. How are you?
Good, Jenny.
Could be. I never know.
You never show.
Until the first day or after the first day or.
To see if I think Ilana Storch is not here today, so I was going to try to record it. And I just have to make sure that, in fact, it looks like it's recording. Okay, well, so be it. Okay, there we go.
How are you doing, Jenny?
Can I give you a check? Not for the class, but for the dinner.
Sure, absolutely.
I just thought, somehow walking in here reminded me of it.
Yeah. It's covered. It's covered the log.
How's your father?
One of my brothers is visiting, so that's always good.
That's nice.
Yeah. Always helps.
Nice to see your mother and show some.
Yeah. Thank you. Pass that along. Look who's walking on her own.
Walking on her own. Dropping her foot.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Oh,
how are you?
That's why I plot myself down. That's the weather works.
This is funny.
Ah, perfect. Okay. Yeah. I have this. I told him I didn't want to take my walker. She's running to LA Fitness.
Oh, okay.
She figured
okay.
out the LA Fitness on top. Okay. She said she'd come in and say hi.
Oh,
she
good.
Picks
oh,
me
good.
Up. But she's like, can I get in an hour? I said, probably you can by the time I get there and whatever. It's like that generation of exercise.
Yeah.
So she doesn't feel good unless she does something every day.
Smart.
Yeah.
She's smart.
Just yeah.
Oh, I didn't actually. How long has she been here for?
She's here for another little over a week.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah, I think on the 17th. She's got it here. She might have a hopeful job for the next month. And so she's waiting to hear from us guys.
He's here.
Yeah, so that would be really wonderful. Otherwise, she's going to stay straight through to my birthday and do all of that. But then when the same job that she finished right before she came, he said, well, that's over, but we may need you to do some stuff in the promotions department just in general rather than the show she was working on. And so when you know when you're coming back to Phoenix, let me know. Mm-hmm. So if he writes her back and says, yeah, you know, can you start on whatever, she's got to go back. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, she's just going to hang. I mean, I love for her to be, and she's freelance. So yes, you never know when
that's
you're
always
working.
Hard, yeah. Right, it's hard to turn down a job because you don't know
yeah,
the next one's
right,
coming.
Exactly.
Yeah. Jenny, the person I need.
Oh, what do you
mean? I need the current email. I tried to send you a picture of that book.
Oh, okay.
And I have a Yahoo. Is Yahoo to work?
Yeah.
Did it come through?
Huh?
I'll have to look.
All right.
Just
okay.
Send it
no, yesterday.
No. It is not coming.
Jenny right. K5 at Yahoo.com.
Speaking of a picture, I have to. That we did,
oh!
We did a reunion, God knows when that was, 20 years
so
ago.
It looks like Sharon, know. November 97.
There you go, yeah, and we went back to Ann Arbor.
No, I didn't hear from her this month. I should email her, because I didn't send her anything either, so I guess I should.
Did you know each other back there?
Oh, no, we have a mutual friend.
Yeah. she was, I think I met her in the dorm freshman year, and then we pledged the same sorority, and we were roommates, we were really good friends. Yeah.
And she was Denise Lansing.
And that she betrayed Michigan and ended up betrayed Ann Arbor and went to East Lansing.
J-E-N-N-I. K5@yahoo.com.
Okay. Okay. Well, for the retreat, you think I should? I signed up for this class online.
Yeah.
Right. And then I thought, well, I can sign up for the retreat online too, but I went, I'll just write a check.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Good.
Good.
Okay. So if it doesn't come through,
I think it's a must. I think we need to impose.
But here's the picture.
Because our retreat was actually supposed to start at 11. So the march starts at 11.
It's really.
So we'll just go to the march and then we'll go from there to the retreat. Because I really think, I mean, it's not the women's march in January is on the day of the retreat.
Oh, well, we have to do both.
Right. So we're gonna go to the women's march, and we're gonna go from the women's march, and maybe we can carpool and so on, just up to the retreat center. And so we'll
miss probably one session, but that's a great session. What you can't do, do better than having a women's march as part of your retreat.
I just wonder in terms of timing, etc.
But we should carpool to the women's march.
How much time is actually going to take?
January.
Well, I don't know that we'd stay for the whole thing. Because otherwise, you know, but if we went
to the route. This was January 13th?
January 20th. It's 20th is the alumni retreat. Yeah. 13th is the new cohort.
Thursday, 13th is our Harry Roz retreat also.
Oh, really?
What is that? What is
our Harry Roz Chef retreat?
Boy, oh boy. So I think,
we'll talk on Wednesday about the program, because
given the state of things,
it's
not a question. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just don't know where do we inquire about, I don't know who's actually sponsoring it or organizing it or what.
Ask that guy if she knows. And she can figure it out.
Yeah.
And we'll figure to stay an hour and a half to 2 hours. Hopefully we'll catch most of it from whatever program there is. And then
it was just a mass of people. I mean, we did have some speakers, but it was just plenty there.
Which one
are you talking about?
The one immediately after
the jerk got into office.
What I heard is that a subsequent rally or march was better organized than that. I've heard reports of that.
Oh, right.
There were 25,000 women there.
And men
and little kids. What bothered me about it was people were using it for other agendas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there was, Palestinian stuff, and I just
you're gonna see that there's no way to avoid it, right?
The 20th.
That's the
day of the women's march.
Yes,
and you have to register.
Hi.
We were just talking about this.
I know that song.
So I'm down
Serious Radio.
Okay, I'm going to put it in my calendar right now.
It's the 20th.
And I'm the person who registers and pays for everything like 2 years later. I'm telling people, you have to register.
Most excellent.
This is her project.
She
Until she got to the point of ritual that you needed ritual transition. Okay. And so the only thing I could relate to is when we dropped our youngest son off college, and he is the origin of Alan's gray hairs. Okay, see, everybody knows what that means, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so we dropped him off at the same university with his brother, which is another miracle. And we got in the car and we said, oh my God, you know, and we said, Shanti wants. I mean, it was just like, oh my God, finally, you know, have them both in college and they're together and they have each other. And we're 3,000 miles away. And it was just one of those moments. When she talked about last night, and she's now a widow of 2.5 months, when she talked about maybe there should be a ritual for when she takes off the wedding.
There is, by the way.
Right. But there was this silence in the room that permeated the whole room as she actually talked about. Should it be private? Should it be with her kids? Should it be in synagogue? Should it be whatever?
Should it happen at all?
Should it happen at all? What does it mean for her going forward for the future? I mean, it was a moment that I don't think I had ever thought about. And my sense from the community we were sitting in, nobody in the room, or very few people in the room had thought about.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
And you could feel the difference in attention to her speech after that.
No, you don't think so?
No, I don't think so.
For those of us who weren't listening, I think so.
Because there were many people in front of me on their iPhones.
Oh, really?
Okay. And after that moment, I didn't see anybody on their iPhones.
Well, that's interesting.
So that's my perception of how people started listening.
It's a very powerful.
That's my data to support
that people started listening better. The iPhones were away.
So, welcome everybody. We're back, finally. The holidays are over. There were so many of them.
Just the same thing.
So let's go around the room and say our names, and then we'll get going.
Jenny Cronenthal.
Ruth Cylon.
Mary Rosen.
Dale Singer.
Anya Jacobson.
Randy Rosoff.
Melise Rosoff, very sweet.
Connie Wolf.
Lana Cantor. Welcome, everybody. Bernice. Related to this young one over there.
She's my mother.
So, our class is called Joan's class. And so I just wanted to say something about Joan. So Joan Baron was this incredible woman who used to sit either where Barry or Bernice are sitting, but definitely that side of the room, with a tremendous sense of humor and this amazingly deep commitment to pretty much everything Jewish. I did hear some great news, which is one of her granddaughters just got engaged this past week. So Mazel Tov, Joan, wherever you are, this is really wonderful. But you can something that Dale often quotes my father as saying is like, you know how you did as a parent when you meet your grandchildren. Well, if there's any measure, you know, if that's a good measure, then Joan was the most spectacular parent possible, because she has this family of just exceptional young people in addition to her children. So we miss her every year, as we say, we were grateful for the time that we had her, and you know, her place in Shul is still there, and anyway, it's nice to think of her as we begin. So okay, so we're gonna go back to Dahlia Rosenfeld, and I just wanted to kind of remind us a little context on Dahlia Rosenfeld, because we read some of the stories, we actually read some of the criticism, and just to remind us that she is a writer and a teacher of creative writing at Tel Aviv University, and I believe that if I'm remembering correctly, they actually went to Israel because of some treatment for a child who had diabetes or whatever. There was something in Israel that was really good for this child, and so they ended up staying there. She's now a mother of a 13-year-old and a 17-year-old, from what I can tell. But you'll notice, you know, from our second story where she talks about the grandson who is the monarchist at the border with his binoculars. But let's read a little bit about. This is criticism, reviews of her book. One of them is an interview with her, and it'll just sort of remind us of the general tone, and if there were things about the stories that you did not fully grasp, it will be explained right here. So Connie, if you would do the first paragraph, and Barry, then we'll go on.
Rosenfeld's debut book of stories is funny, touching, awkward, and wry. In most of the stories, not all that much happens. Instead, Rosenfeld deals with the quotidian and the absurd. Almost all the stories are told in the first person, and most of these narrators share a common voice. Then, too, there are certain images or motifs that recur throughout many of the stories. Lemon trees, migraines, pianos, and books. More than books, some of her characters read compulsively. For hours, for days, almost unceasingly.
So we read an author, and I remember what she said. I don't remember who it was who said it. That what she does is she writes. That her writing comes from what she knows, but in the category of what she knows, it's what she doesn't know about what she knows. Is that totally confusing? That her writing comes from her exploring, let's say, her own life or her family's life, but it originates there, but the story comes from something beyond it. you know, because people are always asking writers, you know, is it autobiographical? And the question, you know, or is it fictional? Well, it's both. It definitely, you know, comes from a place in the author's life, but it doesn't stay there. It becomes a world of its own. Okay.
I drawn the characters whose actions are informed by an inner log that they themselves are not aware of, and that is guided, as you put it, by a state of displacement, sometimes forced, sometimes self-imposed, in which fixed boundaries fall away to give the characters a chance to redefine themselves. But they often squander the opportunity by engaging in a series of missteps or self-sabotage, such as in my story, Swan Street, where Misha, the protagonist, moves to America only to end up in a kind of voluntary exile, avoid situations that would allow him to settle into his adoptive homeland. At the end of the story, I always discover the same thing, that human behavior is inscrutable. It's still fun to write about.
Love that. She always discovers the human brain.
Reisenfeld's stories are primarily told from the first person views of different women, their names withheld, their narratives set in sometimes unnamed locations. They could be young women sitting next to any of us on a bus, walking down a sidewalk, or socializing in a cafe in the United States or in Israel. The location informs the atmospheric details for each character's situation in which she finds herself. But it is ultimately the relationships and human interactions in each story that drive the collective. This is Reisenfeld's gift through her craft. She heightens our longing to cross borders into belonging, to make the foreign experience more intimate through detailed scenes and surreal, pitch-perfect dialogue. The author draws attention to the interactions between two people and the ways we place or attempt to place ourselves into each other's lives.
How's the weather in here, by the way?
Is it warm?
A little warm.
Okay.
I'm dressed for
it. It is cold.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it is.
I'm thinking I have to go back east this week. I was just thinking, what am I going to pack? I don't know what the weather's like.
It's warm. It's cooler here today than it is back in
Florida. Yeah.
Yeah, Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me keep going.
A longing for stability strikes almost all the characters in this collection, but most often it remains unobtainable, too foreign and unknown. While love is the battleground, the war seems primarily to be a conflict with the inner self, as Reisenfeld's characters struggle to unlock the mysteries surrounding them.
The author explains the book's title, The Many More. As familiar as our emotions and passions seem to us, they often assume an unfamiliar face as we experience them. Likewise, the more intimately we get to know the other people, the more we discover sides of them that are maddeningly unknowable, writes. Every person is a world unto himself or herself, intuitive, unfathomable, unpredictable, but most at always endearing, intriguing, lovable. People we want to reach out and connect to so that we can better understand ourselves.
So the worlds we think we know. So familiar, but ultimately unknowable. And the book, as you saw from our stories this morning, you know, has that little sense of mystery always woven into it. So without further ado, any comments on this? A Foggy Day. That is our first story. So it's a song by George and Ira Gershwin. Ina, you knew this before you? Yeah? Okay. It has been recorded by all the greats. Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong, Frank Sinatra. I mean, there are like 25 recordings of this song. So I thought we'd listen to one of them to get us in the mood of A Foggy Day. Oh, and you have the lyrics. On that small piece of paper.
So this is, I don't know him, Michael Bublé?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, good.
A foggy day in London town, I had me low, had me down. I viewed the morning with such alarm. British Museum had lost its charm. How long, I wonder, could this thing last? But the age of miracles hadn't passed. For suddenly I saw you there, and through foggy London town, the sun was shining everywhere. A foggy day in London town had me low, had me down. I viewed the morning with such alarm. The old British Museum had lost its charm. How long, I wonder, could this thing last? But the age of miracles had it passed. Oh, suddenly I saw you there, and in a foggy London town, the sun was shining everywhere.
So, now, where do we find the title happening in the story? In addition to being the title.
So is it on the bus? Is it on the Volvo bus ride?
No, when she's having the rebellion against her piano teacher, mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that she plays in addition to My Gal Sal and Jingle Bells is A Foggy Day. But on the bus, what is the connection of this to the story, in addition to that scene where she actually plays the song? It is, when I was 18 years old, I took a bus to a sad place. I was in London town, had me low, had me down. I did the morning with alarm. The British Museum had lost its charm. You know, the British Museum isn't the same, but it's my mood, right, that makes it lose its charm. And so she begins the story by saying, I took a bus to a sad place. And you don't know whether that's a sad place of the spirit. My mind was wandering and the bus, you know, the bus that is my mind took me to a sad place, or whether it's an actual place. Of course, you find out in the next sentence that it is, she's actually going somewhere. Okay, one more question before we continue. How many of you took piano lessons when you were a kid? Okay. How many of you finished with those piano lessons before, let's say, eighth grade? Okay. Oh, some of us continue to take them. Okay.
Absolutely no time.
Yeah. So, for those of you who were the piano lesson takers, did the story resonate with you? I I just had this memory of a recital. I too had no talent in the realm of piano, and I don't know why my piano teacher had me be part of this recital, but I was playing like, you know, some song from Fiddler on the Roof, and like it was just a catastrophe. And anyway, so the thing that I want us to notice about this is that idea of, she takes a look at something about the mundane. Sometimes it's the absurd, but sometimes it's the daily. A lot of people have taken piano lessons, not piano lessons, music lessons. And most of us who take those lessons, you know, we have interesting teachers. We do not make it to the concert hall. But so, you know, so she's exploring this thing about this woman and her remembrance of her piano teacher. Yes, go ahead.
Most of us. The first thing that we really failed big, because we're now sitting one-on-one with the teacher, okay? And the expectation of the parents who are sending us there and the expectation of our teachers is that we are going to continue to make progress. And when we hit that point where lack of talent prevents further progress, okay, and what you're playing doesn't really sound like music. Because whatever, I mean, our younger son's best friend does have his PhD in music. And it was the day that he came to us and says, you know, I'm good, but Jim's talented. And there's that
difference.
There's that difference, right? For me, it was the first time I really had failed expectations. Mm-hmm. I mean, parental expectations, teacher expectations, my own expectation, because there wasn't the inherent talent. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and that's what I find so devastating about the story, is that, you know, I almost got the feeling that she had these expectations, and boy, reality.
I think it's the interest. I mean, I took ballet and I took piano, and I was interested in ballet and did it my whole life. And the piano part, because I had a very rigid teacher, you had to do your classical basics before you could do anything fun. Here she is playing Gigamama. Oh my gosh. I mean, my brother got to Boogie Woogie. I wanted to play Boogie Woogie and, you know, get into some of the pop. Would not allow that until you got the basics. And I wasn't interested, and I think I didn't stop because of lack of talent. Probably, but it was lack of interest in it, you know, of work. And so she would rather be playing these light things, and he's having her do the
And what we're going to see is they totally don't understand each other. This is a piano teacher who is in one world, and she is in another world. I want to play something less serious. Mm-hmm. What does less serious mean? I don't know. You know, she's a youngster. Okay. While the mother read a newspaper, across from me sat a mother and her baby. While the mother read a newspaper, the child drank from her droopy breast, a stream of milk trickling out of the sides of his mouth onto the seat below. I watched, trying to remember if I had ever been that thirsty, lips dry and cracked from dehydration. I could not remember a single time. Her sense of humor comes in the most funny moments, but where is the humor in that?
You can't remember that.
She's a baby! The baby! You're not going to remember yourself at your mother's breast. But that scene has a nice bookend with the end of the story. Let's just put one finger and then just go to that last paragraph where she says, with great willpower, I heard of the sheep. A pool of saliva formed at the edge of my pillow. I turned my head and swam the other way. You know, so she has that kind of cool beginning of people drooling at different stages of life. The bus made a sharp turn. I turned with it. This is another kind of bookend, right? Because what happens when the bus turns this way, and that's what the piano teacher did. As her fingers were going up, the piano teacher went this way. And as her finger was going down, the piano teacher went this way. So she's having this memory, you know, whether it's that
you know, the bus is also bringing those memories to bear. But oops, I apologize. And she rubs, you know, she brushes somebody. That was a big one. Startled, the man shifted his arm, examined it, and then let it drop. Great, amazing description. Carelessly, when the bus leveled out again, I settled back into place and stared out the window. Outside, the world was engaged in conversation. I tried to read the signs on people's lips as we lumbered by. With the help of gestures, I made out greetings, curses, inquiries, and exhortations. Repeating the greetings to myself elicited more greetings, curses, more curses. When I asked my neighbor for the time, he answered me only in numbers. What's going on there?
It's like when I sit on an airplane seat and I don't want the person next to me to talk to me.
Well,
I'm the man sitting there, right?
This
that's
is
why you have a book with you.
That's right. Well, this is a little pantomime going on because she's not interacting with anybody. She's looking out the window and she's watching their lips move, and it's, you know, silent because she can't hear. But she's trying to make sense because they're doing gestures, like whatever gestures they're doing. So it's like this kind of pantomime situation. She's trying, and she's, you know, sort of, whether it's involuntarily repeating what she makes out from their mouths, and she thinks that is inviting more. This is magical thinking, right? But he answered me only in numbers. What does that mean?
In the main conversation, you just told her exactly mm-hmm. what you wanted.
Right. 5:30.
She's also got the conversation going in her head and the discussions and all that, words and ideas, and he's just very, it's just very
what's coming across
is metric.
Isolation.
Yes.
For isolation, because outside the world was engaged in conversation. Yes. The next paragraph, nobody was waiting for me at the last stop. So
yeah, she's
her isolation.
She's looking at these people. She's trying to talk to the guy here. She's reaching out, but there's no response. So yes, the isolation and the and that wish to engage, and you know, nothing's happening. Okay, nobody was waiting for me at that last stop. Barry, why don't you pick that up?
Nobody was waiting for me at the last stop. I looked in each direction to make sure. 5 years earlier, my piano teacher had waited for me here once a week. Now he was waiting for someone else at a different stop. A vendor stood behind a push cart selling pretzels. One of his arms was looped with pretzels while the other turned the pages of a magazine. I bought a pretzel from his wrist. Before putting it in a bag, he gave it a spin and sang a short, rhyming song.
And this gets into her mind, and she can't get it out. You know, that's also an experience that we have.
I was wondering about that. I have this picture, and I can't see it. I mean, I can see, but I can't see this. No,
oh.
No. I'm thinking of a big pretzel. I'm thinking of, you know, the soft ones.
Right. But remember, and this may not, you know, she doesn't tell us exactly where this is, but in Israel, which is where she lives, what they call a pretzel, it's a round thing, and they put them on the
bagel.
Arms.
Bagel.
Bagel. Yes. And so, so that's what he's doing, and he sings a little song, and that gets into her mind, and then she can't get it out. very cute. Just do one more.
I was not happy with my surroundings. The farther I walked, the less happy I became. After a stretch, I tried to sing the vendor's song, but couldn't remember only the rhymes and not the rhythm. Om pa pa, om pa om, pa om pa. Suddenly, I was back at the sad place, at the spot where my piano teacher had picked me up once a week and led me to the studio. Walking with haste, I would lag behind to watch the way he walked and to make sure I did not walk that way myself.
She doesn't, you know, a teacher, if you're going to learn from a teacher, you know, you kind of, you know, you'd like to be like them. You find something to admire in them or something inspiring. And you know, she wanted nothing like her piano teacher. Okay. Let's see. Connie, do you want to? Once before a lesson,
I spied a single donut, perfectly round, sitting on the coffee table in the studio.
While my teacher adjusted the piano bench, I scooped up the donut and shoved it into my mouth. My mouth was too small and I could barely breathe, but it was my fingers I was worried about, which could not be licked clean no matter what. My teacher sniffed the air with satisfaction before he sat down.
So it's such a great description of, you know, what does a kid do? Snatch the cookie, you know, whether it's in your own parents' house or whether it's someplace else. This is such a kid thing to do. My teacher sniffed the air with satisfaction before he sat down. Teacher's, you know, clueless until. So the lesson always began with a game. Bernice, do you want to read?
My teacher would ask me a question about piano, and I would answer it. Who invented the piano? I don't know. How many strings are on a typical piano? I don't know. Is a grand piano constructed on a vertical or horizontal plane? Vertical.
So this, so she's guessing. So she sees this as that he's trying to play a game with her. But what do we learn from this?
She's not interested, really. She's totally disassociated from it.
Right. And he's not the kind of teacher who can hear disinterest and try to find another way. He just keeps, you know, this is the question game they play every time.
Yeah. Before he gets to what I call a non-yes-no answer, you know, you have two options. I know you're going to guess. But I'm at least not going to put up with yes, no anymore. Mm-hmm. So vertical or horizontal? Yeah, 50-50 chance. Best I can do for you, lady. You know, 50-50 chance, kid.
Right. But, you know, there's no instruction. Could you go read this and find out? Or, you know, it's just...
not teaching either.
It's
he's disinterested, too.
It's suffering. Yeah. It's, you know, it's just terrible. Okay.
And she's 15. So
and she's 13.
This picture of, you know, this gawky 13-year-old.
Yes, and with a disinterested piano teacher, with a disinterested student, and now we get to understand a little bit of how she sees the piano. Bernice, do you want to keep going after the game?
Mm-hmm. After the game, I played a series of scales. When my fingers moved up the keyboard, my teacher leaned to the right. When they moved down the keyboard, he swung to the left. I was not comfortable with scales. Each note followed the next in such quick succession. There was no time to correct the mistake. My teacher explained that unlike in scales, a wrong note in a chord will make a new and different chord. I asked him whether I could play chords instead of scales. He said no.
Just that one line, each note followed the next in such quick succession, there was no time to correct a mistake. This is why, you know, this is where it's, you know, oil and water. You know, that's the whole point of a scale. That's the whole point of practicing scales, which is each note should come very quickly after the next. But for her, it totally doesn't make sense. You know, why should if I don't go dun, 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 I won't have time to correct a mistake. Dahlia Rosenfeld is showing us just how unsuited she is to this particular endeavor. Wendy, do you want to keep going?
In the middle of my fifth scale, I saw my teacher's eyes shift from the piano to the coffee table. I followed them until we landed on the empty plate where the donut had been. Then felt my palms grow moist and my fingers cold. Almost immediately, my teacher pulled out the page of notes and asked me to play Chopin.
Okay, what's the deal with Chopin? It's very hard to play. It is very hard to play. So here, you know, how does she understand him telling her to play Chopin?
He's punishing her.
But it's like a great scene of, you know, you see this in a movie where you're following two sets of eyes drop and he sees no donut and he sees no donut. She gets punished. When do you want to keep going?
I stumble through one nocturne after another, my teacher keeping time with his foot and nodding in approval.
When my fingers moved up the keyboard, he leaned to the left. When they moved down, he leaned even further, farther. Soon I could feel his breath on my neck, and the music came out stiff and rigid like the bench I was sitting on.
Yeah. And he asked me what I meant by serious. I shrugged and said, I don't know. So, Ina, do you want to go on the bus ride home that day? The last paragraph on 56? Yes.
On the bus ride home that day, I thought about the way my teacher walked. His feet turned inward as though following some podiatric pull of gravity.
Right.
I stood up to make sure my own feet had not succumbed to the same force and began to walk down the aisle of the bus. The angle of my feet widened with each step I took. By the time I reached the front of the bus, I was ready to walk the rest of the way home.
Okay. Now we've heard it twice, right? She doesn't want to walk like he walks. Mm-hmm. What's going on there? What is that?
If you have somebody that you admire, you want to emulate them. She wants no part of him.
Yeah. And the way a person walks, you know, we all have an individual gait. They're not, you know, no people walk the same way. And also it's, he's taking a path that she wants to have nothing to do with. Okay. Now she, Dottie Rosenfeld, is the daughter of a Holocaust survivor. And the Holocaust is pretty much present all the time, if not in background or, you know, hovering. And so, the story goes between her neighbor, the Holocaust the neighbor who lost her husband, and this trip that she takes to her old piano teacher's studio area. Okay. Aya, do you want to do one more?
The neighbor, a Holocaust survivor from Hungary, was standing outside her apartment on the first floor, fumbling with a key. When she saw me, she pushed at the door with her shoulder until it opened, then pulled me inside. Do you know my husband died? She said, almost 50 years now.
Dale, keep going.
Later that afternoon, I tried to imagine what it would be like to have a husband who had been dead for 50 years. Every year, another death. I turned on the radio and hoped Mrs. Manners Stephen could hear it. I laid my forehead against the door and counted pilgrims and geese. She had to count. This was the best way to do it. I looked around for it. Fourth note to add to the basic three-note chord of the song and found it in the heel of my shoe.
What does that mean? Found it in the heel of my shoe? She's tapping. And the fourth, you know, she's tapping one, two, three, and then she heals. And that's the fourth note. But what do we learn about her? This is an amazing.
So I think that she, this is, you know, the rhythm is that she's, before she didn't have the rhythm, but here she's got the rhythm, or she's searching for it or something. It has something to do with that. She didn't have the rhythm on the on papa, right? Or
right.
The scales.
Right.
Or the Chopin or whatever else. And so here this is that reference to rhythm and beat again.
Right. No talent when it comes to piano, but when it comes for, remember, and this is a 13-year-old, right? No talent when it comes to the piano, but a 13-year-old who can empathize with an older person and even ask herself questions about what it might be like to count every year of widowhood, this is extraordinary. I mean, I wasn't doing this at 13. This is not, you know, just the kid who clipped the donut. This is somebody who, you know, who is exceptional kind of in her own way. And this is her, this is where she can actually, you know, feel the beat, as it were. Okay. Yes,
but she doesn't feel it for the piano.
Right. No.
But she's also feeling the beat, and she's also thinking of the way she can like this from this movie. And that's what's really exceptional.
Yeah.
I mean,
opens his mind to seeing verdict.
Right. Because she gets the suffering from Mrs. Manelstein, and
she's hoping somebody gets her something.
Right.
But she's all alone on that bus.
And the child, like, you know, is still there. If you have to count, this is the best way to do it. You know, so there's that childlike approach to the empathy. Okay, what were you going to say?
No, just it's the difference in one abstraction over the other. And so this poor man who is, for whatever reason, well, I think about the piano teachers I had, God rest their souls, and things where he goes. You know, maybe you get one or two kids who really like what they're doing and are interested and committed to it, but most of us practice under duress, and we're really terrible. And think about sitting and listening to kids murder music you love. Well, seriously.
I know.
Yeah, murder music you love on a regular basis to earn a living. So, but she has no empathy for him and steals his donut. So, yeah, she's a mixture.
Mm-hmm. But she doesn't like being there, that's why. I think that's it.
She really does not like being there.
Ugly is full.
And, you know, and of course we can see the relationship with Mrs. Marmorstein when she said, do you have any children? I have you. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's, you know, there's a...
I'm sorry.
No, please.
I'm sitting here and I'm remembering my piano classic music, Mr. Hellmuth. And he used to come up. He came to me. He came to us. And this was... This was probably, and it was 50 cents a shot. I remember my mother paying me this 50 cents every week. And, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, I mean, this, what, not, I got none of this when I did this at home. I got, coming here is where I'm understanding it.
Like all of us.
Yeah,
right. Anyway, and I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about scales, and then
right. And
that was something that a Jewish child did.
Yes,
that was
yes.
It.
Music lessons, absolutely,
especially a Jewish girl.
Mm-hmm.
Was a piano, and as I remember, I can still remember. Something about a violin, and I remember my mother said, no, she's not going to strip it in my head. I can remember.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then this Holocaust survivor, Mrs. Marmorstein, who she has this very beautiful relationship with,
yeah.
Is, you know, stuck, right? You know, she how many times is she going to ask, our protagonist, did you know that my husband died 50 years ago? But the great thing about children is she doesn't discount Mrs. Marmorstein for that. In other words, she doesn't, you know, oh, this woman is, you know, she's lost her mind and so on.
Well, that's an interesting counterpoint to the fact that the teacher does the same thing with regularity. You know, he's going to play the games with her, and she's, you know, the one, she's very connected, and she will allow it. The other one is just right in that red flag.
Okay. When I returned to my piano teacher's studio the following week, a donut was sitting on the coffee table again, chocolate covered and conspicuous. I brushed by it like a stranger and took my seat stiffly at the piano. I brushed by it like a stranger. This is, it's at moments like these you can understand why people are so excited about this this book. Because her writing is just, you know, you can see the child, you know, like pretending, and everybody knows, you know, it's the no clothes moment.
What do you think was his intent in leaving a donut there, so visible? You know, was it you can have it, you can't have it, or I'm
wondering about that.
Yeah.
Did he leave it there on purpose for her?
I mean, if he has a donut, it could be in the kitchen. Why is it on the coffee table right in front of her? It's like tempting her to I don't know. I just couldn't come up with a
right. Did he put it there to for her, to like for her, or to punish her, to tease her?
Right. Or what he was going to have, you know, afterwards, you know, that he was that kind of, what's the word? It's not meticulous.
Regimented, it's, or something.
Something with an IOS at the end. It'll come to me. That, you know, he knew that after the piano lesson, he was going to have his afternoon snack. No thought of her and what her relationship to that donut might be. Yeah.
I think he could have given it. That's what I'm thinking. And she failed it the first time. So maybe he wasn't going to let her play Gershwin. But maybe if she did what he asked her to do, she would be rewarded with the chocolate cup again. Mm-hmm. And he knew she liked it.
Mm. Yes. Okay.
It's so interesting that she took the donut before she even played
right.
The first scene.
Yeah.
He left it there for the reward, but she took it.
Right.
And she hadn't played yet.
Maybe it was his reward.
So he says, play Chopin. I place my fingers on the keyboard, pretending his was a reasonable request. In the middle of the first page, I felt a weight on my shoulder. I shook it off and continued to play. By the beginning of the second page, knuckles were kneading my spine. I withdrew my fingers from the keyboard and feigned a forceful sneeze. Before I could continue playing, the question game commenced. Resting his hand on my arm, my teacher asked, does this bother you? I shrugged hard, and his hand fell away. No, no, I said politely. He placed the palm of his hand on the small of my back. How about this? I laughed, then coughed, then sneezed again. Listen, I said, forcing my fingers back onto the keys. Gershwin, A Foggy Day. What's he trying to do with the various touches?
Sexual harassment.
That's right. That's what I thought. That is where our thing goes. But it's not. It's about posture, right? Posture when you're playing the piano.
Right.
It's, you know, he's.
Yeah.
I know. When you're sitting on, you know, the piano bench is very flat. You know, if you're like this, but it's actually two things about playing the piano. One is the back. But the other is how you place your arms.
Yeah.
And so she had her arms like way up here. And so he's putting the hand on the arm to,
I mean, if he wants to teach her about the proper posture,
it's like
you lift your wrist holds it again. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, it was creepy.
Creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a creepy way to do it.
Maturing him,
but it's amazing that, you know,
this is our today, that we all went there first.
Yeah. Absolutely,
yeah, exactly.
Yes, yeah. totally.
But he actually said it as a joke because of what's going on today,
yes.
But it could have been either way,
Harriet. You want to keep going at the foggy day. My teacher watched as I played.
After a foggy day, I played my girl's back.
Oh, yeah, just like two up. My teacher watched as I played.
Teacher watched as I played one long note after the other. Try an arpeggio, he suggested. Arpeggios don't work in a foggy day, I lied, because of the syncopation. after a foggy day, I played My Gal Sal and Jingle Bell, then a few waltzes and a mazurka. Then, when I was through, I stood up and thanked my teacher for the lesson. I've got to catch the bus before it leaves, I apologize. There's only one bus that I can ride. On the walk that day, I turned around every few feet to check if my teacher was following me. On the bus, I turned to the man sitting next to me to see if it was my teacher. At home, I knocked on Mrs. Marmelstein's door to see if my teacher would answer.
Okay. So,
that's why she felt that it was creepy.
Yeah.
I had two piano teachers. Each of them for a long time. They never touched me. They showed me. Mm. They did this.
but they never touched me.
Yeah.
And so to me, their touching was very
inappropriate. Right.
And very inappropriate, absolutely.
But not that he would know.
Right.
He would
but
not know.
She knows because when she touched the man on the bus,
when he went around the corner,
he was repelled by being touched by a 13-year-old girl.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Right.
So she knows that touching is verboten. Okay. And I think that was set up for the touching here.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But you know, in terms of, I don't know, at least where my mind went the first time, you know, you don't take your knuckles on somebody's spine when you wanna, start to grope them in a, you know, and the small of the back, it's about, you know, it's about sitting up straight and so on. I can totally see why it's creepy, because he's not saying anything. Does this bother you? But I don't think his intent is to, you know. Okay.
Also, he met her at the bus, but he doesn't get out of the bus.
Yeah, right.
I mean, they're done.
Right. Anyway, so she just has to get out of there. It's enough already, you know. But she's not a bad player either. I played a few waltzes and a mazurka. She actually can play the piano.
Yeah.
So his, you know, she's achieved a degree of mastery, not, you know, not a concert pianist, but, you know, she can actually, you know, play something. But she's also not secure about her playing. He does nothing to reassure her about the playing. Mm-hmm. And as a teacher, you know you have to, if the kid says, I'd like to play Gershwin, well, you want to go with, you know, the rabbis in the Talmud would say, a person only learns from the place that the heart desires. You know, so you start with that. Maybe you bring them to Chopin, but, you know, you've got to start with where the kid is. But he can't do that for whatever reason. But she's, you know, she sees him everywhere, and she's done with him. Okay. So I'm just putting on the china for a cup of tea, she said. Come in. Ruth, do you want to, I came in?
Sure, I came in. Together we sat at her kitchen table. Oh. Sitting I came in. Together we sat at her kitchen table, sipping tea from chipped porcelain cups. I wanted to know something about Mrs. Murmerstein. Do you have children, I asked. I have you, she said, refilling my cup. When I stood to leave, she held my face in her hand and kissed the top of my head. Do you know that my husband died? She asked, tears streaming down her cheeks. Almost 50 years now. That night, I lay in bed counting sheep. They came in big flocks, 100 at a time. Other people might have been having trouble sleeping then, too. My piano teacher, the pretzel vendor, Mrs. Murmerstein for sure. But I was probably the only one counting. When the rhymes from the pretzel vendor's song started to interfere with my exercise, I tried to shoo them away, but could not. Mellow and fellow, moon and zoom, summertime and baby mine, they filled my head like the music they were a part of. And I did not want music in my life anymore. Not even a pretzel vendor's ditty. With great willpower, I herded the sheep back to me and let them come until I could count no higher. 50,000, 100,000, a million and more. A pool of saliva formed at the edge of my pillow. I turned my head and swam the other way.
So she says, I did not want music in my life anymore. You know, she's clear about that, but there's something, the idea that she's having trouble sleeping, and so she's counting sheep, which somebody told her to do, but then she's also thinking about other people who might be having trouble sleeping. Who does that at 13? You know, we're very self-absorbed until, you know, we eventually learn not to be as much as we usually are. When the pretzel vendor song started to interfere with my exercise, I tried to shoo them away. What?
We're laughing at you.
With you.
Why?
I like that we're not as self-absorbed as we used to be. And I forgot what the way you said it. What was so
as
As we are. Yeah, basically, that we're still self-absorbed, is what you said.
Yes. We are, you know. That's the thing, you know. When we listen to our thoughts, who's the star of the story? It's always us.
My favorite sometimes Jane Austen line is self-will intrude.
Self-will intrude. Totally.
Jane
Austen. Arguably in the judges, I'm sorry. No, okay. They come out automatically. No, well, no, please, that's what my age is difficult. This is a question.
You know, I have to tell you, I loved language math. Oh, no. I loved my teacher. She had been a ballerina, and she had a fall, and she had a bad hip. So she had a walk, a limp, you know. But when she talked about music, she talked about the composer, and she told me about their lives and brought it to me in such a way that I felt connected. We didn't do Bach. We did a lot of Chopin. But anyway, then we moved to California. I got a new piano teacher. And all I can remember about her, Mrs. Boucher, was that she had hair. These open tops, and she had hair and growing hair. And I could not stop looking. And my mother would say, all right, if you want to practice, I'll wet the dishes. I mean, we didn't have dishwashers.
Right.
But I loved it, and my mother took lessons, and she loved it. My sister, so. But it was a wonderful time for me. So I'm sorry for anybody that had this kind of an experience.
So what is the sad place that she took a ride to? The bus stop, right?
Where she got up. Oh, I mean, that's just reiterates in my mind. It was a trauma in her life.
Absolutely.
And she got off at the bus stop. That's where she met her. And whatever happened to her, she could get out of her head. And everywhere she turned, she was afraid he was going to be there. I mean, yes.
I agree. It was traumatic.
But why would you think the bus stop would be the sad place otherwise?
No, the other thing that, you know, is sort of two poles of the story is Mrs. Marmorstein, you know, and it's clear that from a very, very young age, she felt the pain, you know, and she's remembering Mrs. Marmorstein, you know, I don't know if Mrs. Marmorstein is still around, I guess she's still around, but she's remembering, you know, about how Mrs. Marmorstein kept saying that, you know, did you know that my husband died, and so on. And one other thing, which is the kind of weaving together of clear distress with humor and childhood, and, you know, the things that are funny about childhood, that was really quite the feat. Because when I first read this story, all it did was depress me, you know, but then you read it a few more times and you notice, you know, the donut and the funny things that she says and so on. And then it's much more of a, you know, much more complex, much more of a mix.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be very young because this story said to me that just like Mrs. Robinson couldn't get past the fact that she had this trauma fairly early in her life. Maybe she's 90, but if it's 50 years, she was 40 or 45. So fairly early in her life, she became a widow. And I think the protagonist had this trauma in her life and couldn't get past it.
Okay.
It's 5 years later, and she's, why they didn't explain why she was going there at 18 years old.
And I think what happens, you know, when children have good traumas, they only know the trauma from the age they were at the time. They don't get past it.
Right.
Okay? And when they think about it, it's very hard to think about it as an 18-year-old and not think about it as a 13-year-old.
Right.
Okay. And so I think that's what this is saying.
I need to get away from being my 13-year-old self. I am now 18. And, you know, and so that's where I was, where Barry was. Well, the only moment of comic relief in watching this Thursday hearing a few weeks ago. So we unfortunately got sucked in. Once we started watching, we just kept watching it. Is when the sentence came out, oh, I have a weak stomach with spicy food. And Alan and I both burst out laughing. I've told Harry that. Because I can't tell you how many times you hear that in the pediatric office. Mm-hmm. And the next question was, and with the spicy food, how many years do you have? Okay. Because what they told their parents is, the reason they're vomiting is they had spicy food and they have a weak stomach. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you know, because you've heard it 1,000 times, that that's not the story. But it was the story of a 15-year-old, and it was coming out as the story of a 15-year-old or a 17-year-old. And this young woman is trying to get past her 13-year-old story.
And
she's 18, and so she knows she needs to get past it because she doesn't want to be.
That's probably why she went there.
Right.
That's why I think the sad place is specifically a place on the map. It's a place in time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. But notice though that
But if she can get past the place, she can get past the time.
Yeah. But notice, I mean, how many of us remember, like, I didn't have a trauma from my piano teacher, but I can see the room and I know her name, and you know, these are things that, you know, even without being traumatized, you remember because they're early memories.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they are significant. You know, or they, this is another thing we learned from this, the hearings, which is how certain experiences impress themselves on our brains, and why we, you know, why we remember certain things. Now, of course, traumatic things, you're going to remember like certain details and you're going to forget other details. And I don't know. I didn't get the sense that this is about, you know, a groping piano teacher. It may have been, you know, this was a significant experience for her, but I don't think
it's still awkward.
It's very awkward.
Whether it was sexual or the, you know, professional that I was trying to get her, it's very awkward.
Yes, and clear, this is
there
true.
Was no connection.
Right.
Well, yes. I know you used the song, so I was wondering about in terms of the song.
Yes.
So he's clearly the British Museum
that's
lost its charm.
Right.
And so she might have actually liked playing the piano when she played around, but didn't like the lessons, whatever happened. I don't know. I'm mixed with the lessons too. What I want to know is where the sun was shining everywhere. Who was suddenly there that the sun was shining everywhere?
Yeah. So does anybody want to address that before I do? Okay. I don't think she's looking at that part of the song. I think she's letting that part of the song just lop right off because it's too sunny. It's too, you know, it's a kind of Hollywood ending to a down day. That's not who this author is, as far as, you know, I can see. No, she's interested in the melancholy, tempered a little bit by the humor, but I think, you know, and the mystery and what we don't know. Any other thoughts?
Maybe Mrs. Murmerstein brings a little bit of sunshine to the life.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Because she, you know, she knocks on her door, she interacts with her. Obviously, they're both getting something out of that.
Yeah, and she definitely loves her. I have you.
Yeah. Okay, the contrast between being held on the face and kissed on the top of the head.
Right.
Versus
knuckles on the spine.
In your spine.
Yes.
Could not be more stark.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Okay, my friends.
From behind.
Yes.
Behind and the face.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So we didn't get through our our quota. We were supposed to do two today.
Yeah.
I'll have to contend with that. But in any case, so read what we were supposed to do. You've already read Thinking in Third Person. So you can reread that and do the other two stories. And I will figure out what we're going to do about this.
I'm having a really hard time with that third person story.
Can you at least give me an idea of which one is the third person? I can't figure out whether she's Tova or whether she's somebody else and where she's. Can you give us just a little hint?
Yeah, sure. because it comes up in the first sentence. And this is her, you know, she's clearly, she struggles with a disorder. And she's trying to, when you think in third person, you're thinking about yourself as somebody else. And she's trying to imagine herself as one way of overcoming the disorder. You know, if she can think about herself in third person, maybe that will help her get out of the house.
Okay.
I think. We can discuss it more.
We won't be here next week. Is there some way you can record?
Yeah, I'm recording. So I'm happy to record. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Because I read it twice.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Which the thinking in third person.
No, like both of them.
Oh.
So you're suggesting you make multiple readings before we can begin to crack it.
It took me.
That makes me feel good.
Yeah. And you know,
if it took
so
multiple readings, think of how many times.
I chose this book because everybody that I read said, this is just spectacular, it's amazing, she's a new voice, da 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 da. So then I start reading it, and I say to myself, well, I'm going to trust the critics and so on. And I couldn't stand the book. But
that's where we are.
I have come to a new appreciation of her. So. Yeah.
Okay, no, I mean, there's music like that, but I have to listen to it again and again before I, even want to listen to it again.
And I think I just saw Barry's daughter, who we can all get to meet.
And to help me limp along and pick away and drive me.
My
traded in for, you know, the pain from the surgery. So I had like five and a half weeks.
It's still kind of fresh.
It is. I'm on all kinds of drugs.
They do
fusion. Now 4 or 5 fusion. Played around, so I've got a foot draft, which is really, you know.
Is that something that will go away?
I haven't had physical therapy yet. I didn't bring my walker in.
I'm not the only one who couldn't get it.
Something I want to pick up this for you.
The tail six blocks from us.
1 second, I gotta stop the recording.
So Debbie Kale told me she's pregnant.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I like her so much.
Oh, yeah.
What a- so-